Campus FM presents the second talk in a series of lectures by Professor Frieder Steuer, expert in terminology and technical translation. The lecture was organized by the Department of Maltese at the University of Malta and is entitled Terminology Planning, Standardization and Management.
Nilqakom bi pjaċir għat-tieni taħdita tal-professoressa Steers. Naħseb illi l-maġġoranza minna diġa smajnija l-bieraħ u allura m'hemmx għalfejn irrepetu l-introduzzjoni il-kollega tiegħi professur Mifsud għamlinna l-bieraħ dwar il-karriera tagħha fil-qasam ta' terminoloġija. It-taħdita llum jisimha l-ippjanar, l-istandardizzar u l-immaniġjar ta' terminoloġija. Il-professoressa Steers se titkellem għal madwar siegħa u mbagħad ikun hemm ħin għal mistoqsijiet u diskussjoni u sa 8:30 inkunu lesti u barra. Xi żewġ avviżi żgħar qed indawru din il-karta safra min ikun jixtieq jirċievi kopja elettronika ta' noti li qiegħda tuża il-professoressa Steers jikteb l-indirizz elettroniku tiegħu fuq din il-karta u eventwalment jirċevihom. Għandna dejjem ħabriki kollega Olvin Vella li mingħajru ovvjament daw l-inizjattivi. Ma nafx kelli xi informazzjoni iżjed, naħseb bażikament dik kienet hekk joġobkom issa mlew din il-karta u tkunu tistgħu tirċevuhom. Mela nilqa' il-professoressa Steers biex ittina t-tieni taħdita tagħha llum dwar l-ippjanar, l-istandardizzar u l-immaniġjar tat-terminoloġija.
Okay, good evening. I've met most of you yesterday already. My lecture today will focus on standardization and also the way governments and official organizations can handle terminology management and standardization. I hope you all have a handout so that at least you can follow the basic outline. So I will be talking about the principles of standardization as such. What can we expect from standardization? How important is it for our society, for our daily life? What about standards institutes? What do they do? How do they work? How do they proceed? And then more in particular about the standards and terminology. I'll also give some examples about language planning, especially in Germany and in the Netherlands and Belgium. And finally, I will also give some information on useful portal sites, websites, where you can find lots and lots of information on terminology and related information. First of all, let me give you a definition about standardization so that at least we know what we are talking about. Standardization is defined as the process of formulating and applying rules for an orderly approach of a specific activity. That's an important statement to start with. It all has to do with rules and regulations and an orderly approach to something, a specific activity, for the benefit and with the cooperation of all concerned. So it will be kind of a social activity. We have to agree on the standard. In particular, for the promotion of optimum overall economy, taking due account of the functional conditions and safety requirements. This is a very general international definition created by ISO, the International Standards Organization. But as you can see, it is an activity that influences our everyday life and basically all activities in society. Standards can relate to all kinds of objects, composition of materials, safety regulations, quality control, constructing buildings, whatever. Even for we Belgians, the chocolate has been regulated under a standard, because you can't name everything chocolate as such. It has to live up to some standards, and we dearly disagreed with the British on what chocolate was. We thought they didn't know anything about it, and chocolate should not contain too much sugar. On the contrary, it should contain up to 80% or more pure chocolate. So there again, countries can have different interests, but it is important to agree on certain rules, even for food, for construction materials, and also to agree in an international context. So the standard on the denomination of what is chocolate is an important standard, but you also have standards on children's toys and safety regulations. How can children's toys be sold, and what are we dealing with on the level of safety? And then most of you know the ISO 9000 series, 9001, 9002. These are international rules for quality control, very important for companies to adhere. So this is a very general definition of standardization. How are standards created? Well, first of all, there is the International Standards Organization, ISO. Most of you have heard a reference to this organization. You have the ISO 9000 rules, which are international quality assurance rules, and so on. Especially for electrotechnical issues, which is, of course, very important worldwide, there is a special international group called IEC, the International Electrotechnical Committee, which is basically a subcommittee of ISO. But because it's so big and so important, the Electrotechnical Committee has a special group. And then on the level of Europe, you also have European associations and institutes working on this. We have CEN, CEN, le Comité Européen de Normalisation. CEN, you will very find a CEN reference. If you see the acronym CEN with a number code, it means it is a European standard. And then, of course, on the national level, you have the national bodies, such as BSI, the British Standards Institute, AFNOR, Association Française de Normalisation, for France. You have NEN for the Netherlands, BIN for Belgium, DIN for Germany, and so on and so on. So each national government also is obliged to have its own standards authority. And also the Maltese government has a Maltese standards authority. Perhaps, yes, before proceeding to the next slide, it is important to mention that ISO standards are written in three languages. ISO handles three languages, and that is English, French, and perhaps surprisingly enough, Russian. So standards will be available in English, French, and Russian. And it will be up to the national bodies for each country separately to provide translations into the national language. For example, for Dutch, for French, it is done by ISO, but you, of course you have also local standards. But then for German, for Spanish, and so on. So that's an important point to make here. What are we talking about when we talk about terminology standardization? Because we might say that up to 90% of the work of a standards institute deals with standards about products, concrete standards about building materials, about chocolate, about other concrete objects, and about regulations. But part of it also deals with the terminology we use to denominate all these objects. We also have to agree upon this part. And we can call that harmonization. Harmonization, to come to an agreement as to which term are we going to use and how are we going to define the concept of a particular thing worldwide. So there are two aspects. We have monolingual terminology management, where the only idea is that we are going to create a standard or a terminology database for one language, and then we focus upon defining the domain very clearly, explaining the concept system, how is everything related to each other, and then, of course, we write the definitions for each concept, and we indicate a term. How are we going to name it? I have brought some standards with me, and one of it is in Dutch. You don't have to be able to read Dutch to go through the standard itself. It's about water. Water, it has the terms and definitions, so it's a vocabulary list. And here you will find the term in Dutch and then a definition. But this is related to a clear-cut structure in a concept system. Okay. I also brought some other standards, one from BSI about technical manuals, specification for the presentation of a technical manual, and then two other standards about terminology. I'll just pass these on so that in the meantime you can have a look at how the standard looks like. On the other hand, you can also do multilingual terminology management. That means you're going to look at terms and concepts over language barriers. You're going to take a standard, for example, in one language, and you're going to provide translation in another language. And you will have to see whether the concept system also matches the concept system in your language. As I already said, objects of standardization are very often products and processes. The industry pays a big amount of money to be member of standardization commissions. For example, for IBM or Digital or Apple, the large computing companies, it is very important to become a member of the terminology working groups dealing with a particular or with a standards group working on a particular product or process. If they're not involved, they won't be able to make decisions or to steer a particular process into their own direction. So a standards group always works in this way, that people from different areas are invited to join, from different companies, different partners are invited to join the group, and companies pay money to be part of the group, because then they can decide how finally the standard will look like. Very important standards deal with units of measurement, for example. This is very practical, but very important. Safety procedures are dealt with on international level, and a lot of standards have been created for this. Terminology, of course, a lot of standards deal with terminology, but also representation of symbols. Symbols and country codes and whatever, all these will be regulated in standards. Standardization can be defined as follows, or let's see the principles in a sense. First of all, it must lead to an act of simplification, where we have a lot of variety and all kinds of different products going around. What we basically want is uniformity. So basically, a standard will choose one item to be the standard. You all know examples where it works perfectly well, and examples where you, as a user, have problems because there is no standard. Think about going on a trip, on holidays, and you take your hairdryer with you, and you go to another country. In the hotel room, first thing you notice is the plug doesn't work, because there is no standardization. Yeah? You need a match, you need something in between to make it match. This is an example of lack of standards, and basically every customer has trouble dealing with this problem. You can feel it when you are traveling. Some years ago, we had a video standards, and for video, there were no rules. You had VHS, but you also had other systems for video films. Conclusion, when you were traveling, you would like to buy a video film and take it home. It didn't match the system you had at home. Very annoying. And again, markets were lost. Companies had difficulty selling their products. Philips and Sony decided, when the CD audio was developed, the first CD-ROM came into being, and CD audio, to create a standard before the product got on the market. And they agreed on one typical standard for CD, CD-ROM, CD audio. Consequence, You can buy a CD everywhere, it will work. So this is the nice advantage of standardization. So that's why we can call it an act of simplification. It simplifies life for the user, and it simplifies life for the companies who are selling their products worldwide. Very important is that standardization process is a group activity. You can't impose this. There has to be a minimum consensus, either by the group who's working on it, different companies involved, or by the users. It's an activity that is very nice, but if there is no application, if no concrete application follows, then it is worthless. You have to see the standard being applied in concrete tools, of course. And it can be revised, yes. Revision of standards is necessary from time to time, but it must be stable enough so as not to change every 2 years. But revision is necessary over the 10 or 15 years. And it is very importantly a social activity with economic repercussions, as I explained. So it has to be carried by the larger population or community. Another problem is that very often we need standards for very new domains, very recent developments in computing, where the vocabulary, the terminology, and the procedures haven't been established yet. If we make it too soon into a standards process, then this might be premature. It might be too soon to start creating a standard because the technology is still changing. So this could be a danger. But very often companies can't wait. Companies have to do something and have to make decisions. That's, for example, what Microsoft did. When they create a new software tool, they will immediately put, for example, a list of terminology on the internet as their preferred list of terms. Whether we like it or not, this is a semi-standard then, because they own the market almost, and whether you want it or not, even without consulting other companies, they kind of impose this as a standard. Although, strictly speaking, it is not an official standard. This would have to be agreed upon with other companies as well. But sometimes it is necessary to act quickly. I shouldn't convince you that a standardized terminology is very important. Think about legal documents. Most legal documents will start with a list of terms before the actual text to say, in this document, we take this term to mean this, and this term to mean this. This is very important as a kind of conceptual idea of what we are talking about. Although it's very important, because otherwise, basically, you can't read the document properly, as long as you don't know what is meant by every term very precisely, but the legal status of standards is still very much dependent on the attitude in each country separately. For example, in France, all standards are obligatory in use in all government agencies. So everyone writing a semi-official document for a government agency has to use the standards. You can't create your own terminology, or you can't deny the existence of the standards. So every engineer writing about a new application in electricity in France will have to use the standard created by AFNOR. This is obliged by law. The Canadian government, for example, definitely is very strong in creating standards, but in their case, this is more out of a multilingual reason, because they absolutely want terminology to be standardized in a comparative way between English and French. For them, this is the most important reason. Whereas in the Netherlands and Belgium, the standard is not obligatory, not even on government level. So standards in terminology can't be imposed on people. So there is a different attitude from one country to the other. Now let's focus on the terminology commissions, and this is Technical Committee 37, TC37, the technical committee dealing with terminology principles and coordination of terminology. This is the International ISO Commission dealing with terminology. What does this organization try to do? Well, they try to assist all the standards bodies in the world, all the local and national standardization authorities in managing their terminology. They try to enhance communication of content and the worldwide application of technical standards. The standards are passed around, one about computer applications in terminology, the other about terminology and harmonization. They try to help people to implement this. Experts are helped in creating more effective terminology management and an easier access to the fields of knowledge represented in international standards is also one of their targets. Some of the standards the Commission worked on for terminology is the ISO 639. It's an important standard with the code for representation of names of languages. You might think, what is so important about this? But of course, you have to have a unified abbreviation and representation for each language. Otherwise, think about Nokia having language codes in your portable phones, about computers having language codes and so on. If this is different everywhere, then we will get into trouble. It's the same with number plates and country identification symbols. If P is for Poland and PT is for Portugal, it should be like that everywhere. It shouldn't be mixed, or we shouldn't have any wrong translations because then we're confused. It's total loss. ISO 704 is perhaps the most important standard. It's on principles and methods of terminology. I'll come back to that one later. And closely linked with ISO 704 is ISO 1087. And this is the vocabulary of terminology itself. The vocabulary of how we are dealing with terminology. And then ISO 10241 deals with how we create a terminology standard. How do we prepare for a terminology standard and how are we going to write it down? So that's the preparation and layout. A second group of standards that are important for terminology is first of all the ISO 12200. And this is the so-called MARTIF standard. This is very important for companies making software dealing with languages because it deals with computer applications and a machine-readable interchange format. What does that mean? If a company creates a software to build lexical databases and another company builds an electronic dictionary, then you would like the interchange format to match, so that you can copy one database into another and that you can exchange information. Imagine your colleague at a department, a government department, has a database in Access, Microsoft tool, and another one has a very valued database in Multiterm, a Travels tool from a different company. Then you might hope that these two companies use the ISO 12200 standard with the data interface exchange so that at least you can copy and paste data into different tools. So this is very practical. It sounds theoretical, but the ultimate approach is very practical. 12616 is dealing with translation-oriented terminography. How do translators have to work with terminography? How do we register terms in a way that it is comparable in different languages? And then the 12618 and 12620 deal with computer applications. The first one deals with the creation of terminological databases and text corpora, very important, also for researchers at university. And then the second one, the 620, deals with the data categories. In other words, how are we going to install a structure into our computer system where terminology can be listed? So the different data categories, what I was talking about yesterday, the structure of your record, definitions, contexts, entries, and so on, this has been defined on an international level in this standard. The Bible, let's say, the most important standard The first one you should read is the 704, dealing with principles and methods of terminology research. This is very important because there you can clearly see how do I start compiling terminology? What do I have to take into account? And it will describe clearly, if you're looking at a particular subdomain, how am I going to describe the object, the concept, the definition in other words, and the terms related to these concepts. Designations and definitions are clearly defined. How am I going to describe a concept in such a database? And if you read this standard, it will help you a lot. We have to admit it's not enough. You should also have either some linguistic background or you should read about terminology management in more general. But still, it is the Bible, it is the most central document. Here we have a screenshot of the German Institute, das Deutsches Institut für Normung, the German Standards Institute. And as you can see, when you go to their website, it's www.din.de for Germany, Deutschland, and you can immediately see an overview of a number of important actual standards. You can clearly see in their site which standards are brand new, and you can click and select particular topics and see how many standards have been created. One remark has to be made, and personally I think it's not a very good policy, but standards, for all standards institutes, are very expensive. And this is, I think, a bad policy. People would like standards to be used as much as possible. By making them expensive, it won't help the distribution of the standards. So, unfortunately, we can have a look at the website, we can click on particular standards, we can have a brief preview, we can get an idea as to what has been translated into German, for example. If you're doing a translation on a very technical issue, on electricity or whatever, you can clearly see whether there is a standard that deals with this topic, because then you might find all the terminology. It's quite convenient. But unfortunately, you will have to buy the standards. So what is done very often by translators or people working at universities is they try the companies to persuade them to buy these standards as a kind of service tool, and then they can use it. But it is not free, unfortunately. That's the sad thing about it. For those who are into translation, one of the most important standards on translation services so far has been created by the Deutsches Institut. I'll give you the number. It is the German standard 2345. Very easy number. You can easily remember it. 2345. This is a standard on translation offices and on translation procedures. It's quite well known. It has not been translated in many languages, but you can always refer to the German version of the standard. So this is typically a DIN standard, 2345, a German standard on translation. This is the AFNOR site. This is the French Institute of Standardization. Very important and worldwide one of the largest. As I already explained to you, the French think standards are extremely important for them in their communication, in their everyday life. French is also an ISO language, so everything is available in French, and lots of other standards have been translated. They have a very impressive building outside of Paris, and they do an enormous amount of work. So if you're interested into French standards, you can consult their website, and you can see in particular subdomains which standards are available. But there is a lot in French. The same for the British Institute, BSI, the British Standards Institute. Again, you can see which standards are up to date For example, the ISO 14000 series is on environmental issues. So, for example, if for the Maltese government standards have to be applied from the European Commission on environmental issues, these standards have to be looked into and possibly translated into the Maltese language. Then I also selected a screenshot of the NEN ISO 1087. 1087 is the standard on vocabulary of terminology. This is a screenshot, as you can see in your handout, from the Dutch Institute of Standardization. But there you can read the content of this standard. It says, it establishes a basic vocabulary for theory and application of terminology work. So this is a useful standard. I don't know whether it has been translated into Maltese. I don't think so right now. But this would be a good exercise for the Maltese Standards Authority to translate this one as well. Also for the Dutch language, for German, for other languages, every local institute has to do the translation on the spot, because strictly speaking, the standard is only available for French, English and Russian to start from. And then finally, I have selected the site from the Office Québécois de la Langue Française. This is the French Institute, the French Language Institute in the Canadian official services. As you know, Quebec is French-speaking, and they also created an enormous amount of information on standards and how government services have to handle standards and have to use them. So they can also provide good examples for you and see how you can proceed with the work. On top of that, on the left-hand side, in the yellow part, you can see the top line says Le Grand Dictionnaire Terminologique. If you would open the website and click on that, you would find a wonderful database, a terminology database, French-English, which has been created according to all terminological standards. It is very interesting to have a look at that. So Le Grand Dictionnaire. So you can access it through this website from the Office Québécois. You can also just type over the internet www.granddictionnaire, in one word, granddictionnaire.com. Then you access the database immediately. As you see, this is a growing collection with many subdomains, all kinds of domains that are of interest to government agencies in French English. So a very, very good example. So far for the different local institutes. Another very important European standard has been developed very recently. It's brand new. The European vote was only taken 3 weeks ago, and it was unanimous. All the countries in Europe that worked on this standard agreed on this standard about translation services. So it deals with all the terms and definitions about translation, the basic requirements. What do you need to create a translation office? The translation service provider and the client, how is the relation? How do you approach your client? What are the rights for the client? What are the rights for the translation provider? All the procedures in how to make your translation service work as good as possible. For example, do you need revision? Do you need proofreading? How are you going to check and validate your translation? And all the added values related to this. So it's a general standard on European level about how a good translation office should behave. It's very valuable, and it has been voted a couple of weeks ago for the whole of Europe. So I will elaborate a little bit on its purpose, because I think it's quite important. So it's about requirements on how to provide quality translation. How do you do this? Imagine you graduate from university, You want to start your own translation office. How do you do it? How do you try to get a good customer relationship, and how can you guarantee a particular service? So it deals with quality assurance. Also the ability to trace progress. What are you doing as a translation office to guarantee a kind of quality control? How do you evaluate, for example, freelance translators? Do you have a procedure for this? And how do you go about it? Think about LISA, the Localization Industry Standards Association. I didn't mention them here, but LISA has a wonderful concept about evaluating translation of software. So LISA, if you just type lisa.com, then you will find the website of the localization standards industry. Localization, in their terminology, deals with software localization. How do you translate software? Very important problem, of course. Because software translation means you translate the menus, and that what is visible from the outside, what the user will see, but you very often you have to go in the programming itself to check whether your translation matches control keys and programming tools. And you have to translate the help files, and everything has to match. Now, in software translation, quality control is very easy. If you as a translator have done a translation job and translated a particular software, imagine you translated Microsoft Word into Maltese. And finally, the first version is released onto the Maltese market. I've heard that this will be done soon. Imagine that it doesn't work. There is a bug. It's very clear, translation is wrong because at some point they made a mistake in the translation of the menu system, or they forgot to do a shortcut key. What I mean here is the following. Imagine the English version of the software. In Microsoft, you have for print, it's always print, and it's control P because of the P of printing in English. Now, what happens if you translate that into Maltese? Are you also going to change the shortcut key into control something else or not? But everything has to work and everything has to match. So the moment you make a mistake in your translation, the software won't work. And very often that is what we experienced with Dutch. If you buy a Dutch version of a software, well, I'm not sure, there will be some bugs and so on. It won't work properly. In the LISA standards, they call this a fatal error. It's like, translator, bang, you're dead, because your product doesn't work. Obviously, paper is very patient. You can write a mistake on paper and nobody will kill you because, I mean, it's there on paper, you first have to discover it. But this is a software, so you feel that it doesn't work, right? So they also did a lot of work on quality assurance. It's very interesting for those who are interested to have a look at the LISA standards for quality assurance in translation. It also helped us at our own institute to evaluate translations of students. Some of the insights of the LISA quality assurance are extremely helpful. So what the SEN standards wants to do also is a transparent description of the entire translation process. How do you start the process? How do you do your revision, your proofreading, and so on? And then certification, of course, is envisaged for those translation services who can match with the standard. Those who live up to the standard, they get an official certification, such as another service can have an ISO 9000 standard. These people, these translation offices, they will also get an official certification. So it deals with human and technical resources, it deals with quality and project management, the contractual framework, and everything involved in the actual translation process. It's very important to remark as well that this standard is only for translation and not for interpreting. We hope that another standard will be created for interpreters. But so far, this has not been regulated. Okay. A second item that deals with standardization and that is extremely important in terminology management is classification. The more complex your data structure gets, the more subdomains you're going to deal with in your terminology database, the more you will have a need of classifying your data. It's the way you work in a library. If you are at home in your own personal library, you don't need a classification because you know how many books you have and how you have ordered them personally. But the moment you step into a university library, you want a coding system, a numbering system, and subdomains. Oh, this is linguistics, and there I will find law, and so on and so on. So you need a kind of systematic organization of your data collection. This is important also in terminology. Now, again, if you use a particular coding system and your colleague uses another one, then it will be very difficult to find a match afterwards. Which subdomains are we talking about? So again, we will try to strive towards a kind of uniform classification system. You may think that this is very obvious, but when I started translating, I also thought that in the medical field, the whole world would agree on one unique classification of the subject. Because for me, the medical field is quite transparent, and I would expect a medical doctor in China or in Malta or in the UK to consider the same body parts and to deal with the medical structure in the same way. This is absolutely not true. I was quite naive when I thought that, because for the biomedical field alone, worldwide, we have 19,000 different classification systems. So it's very difficult to get an agreement among specialists. Now, you're a very nice audience, and you're just sitting here and listening to me. But if we would have this room filled with medical doctors, all specialists on the same field, let's say dermatology, they would disagree on every single subject in dermatology. Because one expert would say, yes, but this is a disease that relates to this and this and this, and I will classify it so and so. And another medical specialist will say the opposite. So it is very difficult to come to a universal agreement about classification. I once asked our computer specialists at university to give me a kind of concept structure for ICT, information and communication technology, because we would like to create a database with terminology on computers. So we said, well, let the experts write a concept structure and we'll just fill in the terms there where they belong. Discussion all over, no solution found. Because some experts will say, oh, that's easy. You start with a binary structure, computing, and you say there is hardware and there is software. And from this structure, this tree diagram, we'll continue to divide everything in hardware and software. Looks fine. But then another one will say, yes, but I don't agree. Let's start with the types of computers there are. We have mainframes, we have mini systems, and we have personal computers. And the software related to the mainframe is completely different from the software related to the personal computer. Is this person mistaken? I don't think so. You can have 100 classifications, and they will all be correct in some respect, but it's very difficult to come to an agreement. So that's also the general idea is we would like a classification system to work so that at least we can find where we are in the actual structure of our subdomains. This is a problem, a typical problem for a terminology database. Think about the term sinus. In a general dictionary, sinus would be in the dictionary and you would get all the definitions, polysemic, one after the other. In a terminology collection, that's impossible. If you're working in a medical subdomain, your terminology database deals with the medical field, and then the sinus is the cavity in the nose, right? So this is a very particular definition, and we don't need any other information. It's only that in medical field. But if your database is about botanical elements and about plants, then a sinus is the form of a particular leave. Completely different, but then we don't need information on the medical aspect. And if we're dealing with geometry, then in mathematics, it's a completely different aspect, right? So in terminology, it's the subdomain that defines the meaning and the definition. We'll only have one. But we will have to have an indication when we look at the record for sinus. I need an identification of the subdomain. I have to know whether I'm working in the medical field or whether this is the subdomain of mathematics or whatever. So this is important. So what do we need when we look at classification? Well, it has to be easy for the user to use the database. That's the most important question. It's the same when you go to your university library or to a large public library. Easiness of use is most important. So I want to know that, oh, number 8, this is linguistics. Number 10, everything coded over there is mathematics or whatever. Easiness of use, no matter what system it is. Preferably not too detailed, because you can go into very complex numbering systems. On the other hand, it must be clear, transparent, but also complete. So not too long, not too complicated, but yet it has to be complete. So this is also difficult to realize. The first, and for me the best system, is a very simple system for terminology, that is the LENOCH code. LENOCH is the classification used by EURODICOTOM, which is at present still the largest terminology database from the European Commission. EURODICOTOM can be accessed through the website of the European Commission. It's free, but for the last half year, it hasn't been updated anymore. But still, it's an excellent collection. What is there is good. Why hasn't it been updated? Because they're changing the system. They're building a new platform where everything will be integrated. And this platform is called IATA. I-A-T-A, IATA. This is the Interagency Translation, whatever, something, activity. I don't recall the exact. It's an Interagency Translation and Terminology activity. Because before, they had several terminology databases, one for the European Parliament, and one for the European Commission, and still another one, and it was too complex. So they try to combine it and build one. And that's why we have to wait right now until IATA is available and is open for the public. But EURODICOTOM is still open and is very good. So they use the LENOCH classification. What does it mean? It's a very simple thesaurus. It only gives you very straightforward names for subdomains, like medicine, biology, zoology, and so on. Nothing more. I'm convinced that for that type of database, this is enough. You don't need to know much more than that. But only for this type of database. In some other cases, you might require more information. And that is the most well-known, probably, and that is the UDC code. I take it you all use UDC because most libraries are into UDC code. Every library has a classification of books, and so every number reflects a particular subdomain, such as social services, mathematics, linguistics. Worldwide, it's the same. That's why it's called Universal Decimal Code. It is universal. So it is used in libraries, and you could say, why not use it in terminology collections as well? Because at least it's transparent. When we're talking about medicine, let's simply use the number dedicated to medicine in UDC, and you have the same in your library system. So definitely, that is an advantage. I have nothing against the system. On the contrary, the compatibility worldwide is clear. Definitely, if you work together with a library system in your service, it is very useful to have the same coding. The only disadvantage is that it gets very detailed. As you can see, 331.21 deals with wage payments. 331.221.1 is the wage system then and so. For me, you don't have to go that far into the coding. You can also stick to the general names of calls. But you can imagine that for each terminology record you're creating, you have to type these numbers. It might be a bit too much. So you can, of course, stay upon a more general level. And then the third one that is well known is the ICS code, International Classification for Standardization. It is also a numeric code, so it works with 1.2 point and so on. It is also international, but it is only used in standardization bodies, so in the standards institutes themselves. Again, you can decide yourself, do you work a lot with standards, then you might use this code. Do you work a lot with libraries, then you might prefer the UDC code. Or for your own purpose, if you're just a freelance translator working on your own, you can do something like the Lenoch code and just add very general identifications of subdomains. But it is important that some type of identification is used. Okay, that's the first part of my lecture dealing with standards and the classification systems. I will continue immediately with the second part, and you can have questions afterwards, because this deals with how different governments and how different countries have implemented a terminology infrastructure. It just might give you some ideas as to what possibilities there are and as to what can be useful in a country. I've picked out a couple. I will tell you briefly about the European Terminology Association and about some organizations in Germany and in the Low Countries, that is the Netherlands and Flanders, part of Belgium combined. But this will give you a good idea as to what is possible. First of all, a short word on the European Association for Terminology, the EAFT. This deals with the whole terminology community in Europe. So they try to promote terminological activities. They try to improve the knowledge on terminology. They have an international council, let's say. The president right now is Ruud Costa from University of Lisbon in Portugal. And they have members from Denmark, Belgium, Ireland, Spain, Sweden, and Lapland. But this council is changing regularly, and they try to include people from different countries. So why not have a Maltese representative next? I've given you the website where you can read about their activities and what they try to do to promote terminology. For example, in February, they had a very interesting conference on ontologies. It was held in Finland. And it was really worthwhile to see how you could conceptually organize your databases. And if you're into more philosophical discussions about ontology and structure of subdomains, this was really worthwhile. So they have aspects and activities in different countries on different topics. And then let's have a look at the German situation. First of all, there is DEUTER. This is the Deutsches Informations- und Dokumentationszentrum, so it's a center for documentation on terminology. They try to collect, evaluate, and distribute all kinds of information on terminology. And they also make available data on what you can get as electronic terminology collections for German, that is, specialist dictionaries, and so on. They also give advice to companies. So this is also one of their tasks. If a company requests information on the creation of terminology for their particular subdomain, then this institute can help. My colleague Klaus-Dirk Schmitz is responsible. He's a full professor in Cologne, and he's quite active in terminology, also for companies and for translation units. You also have the website where you can find all the useful information. Klaus Dirk started a project on terminology data in 2001. By coincidence, we were teaching together at a terminology summer school in 2001, and we discovered that we had the same project. I had received money from the Dutch government, he had received money from the German government, and both we had to do the same thing to build a website on terminology. Let's call it a terminology portal, where you could find everything in relation to terminology for the local language, of course. So he had to do it for German, I had to do it for Dutch. And we decided to work together. And the result now is that both websites are identical in structure, so that you can easily go from German to Dutch and that you can compare the different data. So he created this website. You can find all relevant information in relation to terminology, of course, always in relation to German. Yeah? And the partners were companies. As you can see, Volkswagen was involved, for example, because companies really need information on terminology, and also ourselves, so Lesius was involved. You also have the website. So if you just type the address, you can have a look at this Deutsches Terminologieportal, and the Meta website, a portal site, where you can find information also on standards, information on terminology collections, where you can find them, and so on. So for those dealing with German, I think this is very useful. So this is the screenshots of their website. And the structure is basically the same with the Dutch side. So you have data collections, mit Terminologiebestände, Ausbildung, so the training at higher institutes. You have all kinds of tools, you have standards, and so on. And then finally, there is a third association, let's say, in Germany, and that is the Deutscher Terminologietag, DTT. And they try to answer communication problems in all kinds of technical areas. So very often, again, companies will come to consult them, but also translators. They try to raise awareness on the field of neologisms. Yesterday, I was talking about how do you handle term creation. For German, this is also very difficult. Very often, what are they going to decide? The English term, is it accepted or not? Or are they going to create a German term? So this organization tries to advise people on which neologism to create or how to choose a particular term for a concept. And again, the Institute of Klaus Dirk Schmitz is involved. It's the Fachhochschule in Köln that is responsible for this organization. So that was the situation in Germany, where they try to get a clear interest also from companies and from translators in the field. And then finally, I will talk about what I call the Low Countries, that is the Netherlands and the Dutch-speaking parts of Belgium, Flanders, because we joined efforts and created a particular structure. And I think perhaps, well, it might give you some ideas as to what is needed in language planning, in language policy. First, it is important to realize that Dutch is a small language in the sense that we only have 21 million speakers of the language. It's one of the smaller languages. I know Maltese is smaller, but it doesn't mean that it is less appreciated. On the contrary. So basically, it all comes down to the same thing. We're not large enough to compete with English, or with Chinese, or Japanese, or Indian, or Russian, and or Arabic language. That's it. All the others are small languages. Even the French language is a small language. They don't like it, but it's true these days. So, luckily enough, in 1980, both ministries of culture, so from Flanders and the Netherlands, and both ministries of education from both Flanders and the Netherlands, so four ministries together, decided to establish the Nederlandse Taalunie, the Dutch Language Union. The idea was we need a common policy for Dutch. We're one, we're united, we speak the same language, we have one official grammar, we have one official dictionary, although there are regional differences in pronunciation and so on, we still have one official language. And together you're stronger, of course. We are a strong economic area, but still it's a small language and we don't have the necessary resources to do everything. So as I said, you have four ministries, there is a joint program with one budget. This immediately excludes that, for example, in Flanders, we're going to create a new dictionary, Dutch-French or Dutch-Maltese, without the Dutch knowing it, or that another university in the Netherlands does the same project. We don't have the money to do the same thing two, three times. Also in language technology, University of Groningen up in the north might do excellent work on term extraction. Well, it would be very stupid to repeat the same work in Antwerp or in Ghent. Why not join efforts and do your research together? We're too small to have two or three prototypes of the same thing. The active policy concerns the following subjects. That is spelling. There is a language advisory committee. On questions such as how to write the words and things like that. There is Neerlandica Extramuros, which means that we support universities and institutes that establish a Dutch chair. So if the language is taught somewhere, you get money to do that. Perhaps an idea, who knows? So you get books, you get a library, you even get lecturers for that. Then there is the issue, very important issue, on language technology. I will come to that later on. So we join efforts. And there is the important question of the language resources. How many dictionaries can you create? Terminology management, are you going to do this only once or are you going to spread activities where it is not necessary? You can have a look at the websites. There is an English page included, but of course most of it is in Dutch, I'm afraid. And you will find general information and specific information on particular issues such as language, culture, and so on. But as I said, there are English pages that give a resume. The project groups I would like to touch upon briefly are the following. So I'm not talking about Neerlandica Extramuros, I'm not talking about spelling, that's another issue. I'm just talking about things related to terminology. First of all, there is CLVV, which is the Committee on Lexicographical Tools, that is dictionary creation. Second, there is CoTerm, the Commission for Terminology. And third, there is TST, that stands for the Language Technology Group. Both spoken language technology, so speech data, and text data. Apart from that, there is NLTerm, which is a terminology association, which is not part of the Taalunie, but it is related to it. I will explain the work of these groups briefly. First, a brief word about the association. NLTerm is an association that was created in 1979. It is also supranational between two countries, Belgium and the Netherlands combined, and it is a free association with members. Both companies and individuals can join, and we try to organize conferences on terminology. We've had conferences on medical terminology, legal terminology. This is also awareness raising. Companies will join us, experts will join us, and this is quite interesting to continue in this way. There is a website, nlterm.org, which you can have a look at to see how such an association works. But this is completely free. It is based on the internal rule of the association. It was not founded by the government or so. It was really a membership association created by individual people. Then you have the Commission on the Lexical Resources. And what is important here is that as Dutch is quite a small language, no commercial editor is interested in publishing dictionaries for smaller languages. Of course, we do have dictionaries for Dutch English and Dutch French and so on, And these dictionaries will be supported by commercial editors because they know they will sell a lot of copies for English and French and also for German. But it is not that obvious to create a dictionary for Dutch-Hungarian, two small languages, or even Dutch-Arabic language, or whatever, Dutch-Swedish, and so on. No commercial editor will take this as a challenge because they know they won't sell enough copies, or they're afraid that they won't get a break even here. So here, investigating the needs for Dutch was the first thing. Have a look at the market. We were not going to fund another Dutch-English dictionary, of course. There are plenty of those. We first investigated the needs in the market. Financial support was given by the TaalUnie. Priorities were defined. And over the last 10 years, more than 15 different dictionaries have been published in this way, always combining Dutch with one of the smaller languages. But the idea is to have a dictionary for every single one of the European languages. So if we can continue a little bit further, perhaps Dutch Maltese will be one of them. Second is the language technology platform. Taal and Spraak means language and speech, so it's both for the speech technology, spoken data, think about mobile phones, think about systems in your car where you can speak to the computer in your car and so on. All kinds of speech data, speech recognition and so on is quite important. And the language technology, among other things, for translation. So TST is a platform for universities, research institutes and companies. And due to the activities combined, they know each other now. We know where the individual researchers are and where the companies are that are also doing research and development in the area. So they join efforts. We can't afford individual initiatives. When you're too small, it's impossible. Okay? And I think this is a good model because we have the knowledge infrastructure. We know which university has expertise in what. We try to steer a little bit the development of technology and applications. If we already have a tool for terminology extraction, we don't need a second one. Let's try and focus on something else, something we don't have yet. And we also consider the end users. The end users can really say, this is what we need. Why don't you create this or this tool? Also for disabled people, we need a lot of speech data and speech development. So speech-driven technology for disabled people is very important, and we can't accept it that this technology is only available in English, for example. We need it in Dutch for our own end users. So priorities are set there wherever needed. So as I've said, bring together the researchers, stimulate joint research. So for example, for the time being, we don't, surprisingly enough, we don't have a good term extraction tool that deals with all text types. We do have small tools, but they're not perfect. So we try to build a good terminology extraction tool now. We also stimulate education and training. I heard here this afternoon that there are not enough students interested here in a career in language technology, but this is a booming business. It's very important to try to get bachelor and master degrees in a kind of what we call alpha informatics, or let's say computational linguistics, people who have a training in linguistics and in computing. Very interesting for a career and very interesting applications. So we try also to see where we need to have more students for these technologies. And we stimulate companies to share their experience. Companies are also not on their own. They can use young researchers to join them and to combine the efforts. So another important aspect is that, as you know, in the European Commission, there is an enormous amount of translation work, far too much for human translators. We'll talk about that tomorrow, but even with a maximum employment rate, they can't find the experts they need for all the translation work. And even then, it is physically impossible to do it all. So the machine will not take away the jobs, on the contrary, but the machine is absolutely necessary to help translators. You should also have a look at it from the point of view, the boring work, the repetitive work can be done by the machine, and the translator gets more time for the more interesting and creative texts that can't be handled by the machine. For example, if you have a file on, let's say, food safety regulations and the EU legislation, let's say this is 3,000 pages, it will be run through a machine translation tool over the weekend. I had the experience with my students. We work with SysTran machine translation. We sent the text over the internet and asked for an email-based translation. So my students had a very strange experience. A text, 2 pages, was sent to Paris and back, and after 1 minute, we had an answer and a translation. So this is something hard to grasp. Like, how can this be done? Well, it's the machine, of course. No human translator can speed up and can produce pages and pages and pages automatically. It is not interesting because it's also very boring as a job on its own. So very often, texts, large texts, are being processed by the machine over the weekend, and then during the week it is decided which parts are very important, so you get a draft translation, which is bad. Definitely it is poor quality. But you get information gisting, you get a basic idea as to what the text is about, and then people decide which parts need to be translated by human translators to get a proper edited text, or which parts have to go for revision by a human person who will do revision of machine translation. Now, again, all the companies working in the field of machine translation and other tools, they're only interested in the larger languages, again, because of the amount of software products they're going to sell. They want to sell English, of course, French, combinations with Chinese, Korean, other languages that have a larger public. No single company is prepared to do the development for Dutch. They're not interested. They don't do it. We need government support to do that. Now, this is a choice the government has to make. Either you don't provide any language technology. Simple. There is no translation for Dutch then. It's not available. Or you do supply machine translation, and at least your language keeps being in the running, and you keep going on in translating these texts. And this is what happened for Dutch. We decided that NL Translex, that is the machine translation project, had to be organized Dutch-French, French-Dutch, and Dutch-English, English-Dutch. How did it happen? 1/3 of the money was provided by the European Commission, 1/3 by our own government, and 1/3 by the company who developed the tool. So you could turn the reasoning around and say the company got 2/3 of its research paid, and then they're prepared to take the risk to do the research on their own. So this is what happened. And also we try to create large corpora, speech data, and so on. A corpus of spoken Dutch has been created that can be used by all companies, for example, who want to create language technology tools, portable phones, navigation systems in cars, and they need speech, Dutch speech. They can use it. Stevin is the project that funds all this type of project. So this is the funding money that is available every year. So NL Translex, I already explained to you, it's a development of this machine translation tool. So either you do it and you're in, and your language will be taken into account. On top of that, machine translation is always a learning system. The translators who use it, they report back on the mistakes found in the tool, and the system is updated. So the more it is used, the better it gets. For example, for French-Spanish, the translators use it so often that right now it has 99% of accuracy. It was not like that in the beginning, but they updated it and they continued to use it. And then they start liking it because after a while it really produces good results. Again, machine translation only works in restricted subject areas, very technical and highly repetitive. It is not a tool that will solve our translation problem in general. Then the other commission I was going to talk about is CoTerm, the Commission for Terminology. And here we deal with all the problems related to terminological activities. We have experts from different areas in the committee, people from education, people from companies, government services and standardization, both from the Netherlands and Flanders. And we develop a common policy and we initiate projects on terminology. And our nicest project for the time being is NetTerm, the terminology portal, where you can find all information for Dutch terminology. It's the same as the German one. So this was the work plan that is not that important. I can skip that, I think. I'll just say a word on NetTerm. You can have a look at the website yourself. It's a permanent database and infrastructure for terminology. And you have links with all the international networks, so with the European information platform, with TDCnet and all the other information available. So if you have a look at the website, netterm.org, of course it is Dutch, but still it might give you an idea. It gives you lots and lots of links to other websites on standards, on international organizations and associations, so you can find a lot on these sites. I think that's all what I wanted to tell you today. Perhaps, again, a bit too much for one evening, but I'm open for questions.
Grazie, Professoressa Stairs.
You have just listened to the second talk in a series of lectures by Professor Freda Steuer, expert in terminology and technical translation. The lecture was organized by the Department of Maltese at the University of Malta and is entitled Terminology Planning, Standardization and Management.